video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This segment, Mr. Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
Thank you for taking time again to talk to listeners of Black Op Radio. And you have many things. We haven't been on for a little while, so things are hopping at Kennedy's and King. Give us an update, and we'll get into what your most recent article is.
Well, you know, I have to say this. You recruit the people that we have onto your show. Like last week's show you did. I think that was the one with Mark and Monica, right?
Yeah,
okay. Well, those are the two lead articles at Kennedy's and King right now. And I think they're both really, really, really important articles. And I'm really glad that you had both of those people on. Mark, of course, anybody who listened to that show will understand. He's a prominent Florida attorney who, out of nowhere, emailed me one day and said, you know something? I'm really interested in this JFK Records Collection Act and the ARB. I mean, if you need anybody to do any work on this for you, I'll be glad to help. So this was like a gift from heaven, and he did several articles for us, and now he's done this letter to Luna, which I believe is a very, very important thing for everyone to notice, and I'm really glad you had him on. Monica Wiesack, again, if you remember, maybe you do, maybe you don't, she emailed us out of nowhere and said, I have a book coming out. I never heard of her. Okay. And that was her first book, America's Last President. And then we had her on your show. I think you had her on your show twice, didn't you? Maybe three times.
Right. Okay. I have anytime she has an article or a book, I have her on and just respect her work. It's so refreshing. There's these, you know, the internet is full of trolls and people just pushing whatever. And then you find somebody doing really good work, you know, like you mentioned, Mark and Monica, you know, just they're wow. They're really, you know, just doing good work and of interest.
Right. And it's also important that Monica is done two books. She did one about Kennedy's, which I believe is the best book about Kennedy's presidency in recent years. Okay, America's Last President. I cannot recommend that book strongly enough. And then I think her other, what the title of her other book is Echoes of a Lost America. That deals more with the assassination itself, whereas her first book dealt with Kennedy's presidency. And that's a good book also. Now, her article, I think she has a Substack now, and her particular article that she emailed to me and that she was talking about with you, that is how RFK Jr.'s attitude towards the whole Israeli-Arab conflict is so different than his uncle's. Now, I thought that was a very, very interesting article. We have a link to that in our news section at Kennedy's and King. She wrote it for her Substack, so we didn't print it there, but we went ahead and did it as a news item. Now, the another one that you have is Mr. Washburn. And I have to say, really, you know, I've been in this field for approximately 32 years, I've been doing it 24/7. Before that, I was kind of intermittent. Okay, I would get into it, then drop it, get into it, and then drop it. But since about 1992, 1993, I've never seen a better article on Crawford, on Larry Crawford, than what John Washburn did for us. He's another guy, by the way, who just came out of nowhere, you know, and he emailed me and he said, you know, I've been doing a lot of work on this JFK case. Do you mind if I run a couple of articles by you? All right. And that's how that happened. So evidently, new people entering this field are either aware of me or you or both. Okay. And they've gone ahead and they've contributed. And I have to say this. I'm really glad we have these new people. I'm doubly glad with Monica because she's a female. And the second thing is she's young. And we need more of those kind of people in this field. Now, also, something else about Monica. I'm sure you're aware, Lynn, of this series called Ford Died Trying by Libby Handros and John Kirby.
Right. I had her on as well.
Oh, you did. That's correct. Yeah. You had them both on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They've run into a little problem, and they couldn't get the next installment out. But she sent it to me, you know, in a closed circuit kind of condition. She just wanted me to look at it. And Monica is one of the main talking heads in this next installment. And I thought she came out very, very well. All right. So those are some of the new things that are up at Kennedy's and King. Now, one of the things I want to talk about tonight is, I think everybody listening to this show is suitably appalled by what is going on in Gaza. It is really a sickening kind of slaughter to watch this. And the fact that neither one of our presidents are willing to do anything about it. Joe Biden said something like, Israel has a right to defend itself. I couldn't believe he said that. Israel has a right to defend itself. Bombing daily and sending the Israeli army to go ahead and eliminate civilians, that's a right to defend yourself. And Trump got 100 million from Miriam Adelson, so he's not going to say anything about it either. Okay. You know, Trump, you know, when you really think of this, Trump had the opportunity to show the world how different he was from Biden. He could have gone in and done something about both these wars that are going on. You know, Ukraine versus Russia and Israel versus Hamas. Well, this is how many months now that he's been president? What is it, 7 or 8 months now? Okay, and as far as I can see, he has moved the lever very little, if at all. And this shows you, I believe, the triumph of the neocons. They sprung up in the 90s, and slowly but surely they took over the whole foreign policy spectrum in America. And that was sort of like the final split for the Democrats from what JFK was about. That was it. That was like a grand schism that cut off the Democrats from their heritage. And it lasted forever. And I don't think it's ever going back. You know, and the fact that Biden was an Irish Catholic and he subscribed to this neocon foreign policy is just startling, really. This is all a prelude to what I've been writing about on my Substack site. And I have to say, I'm kind of really surprised, almost startled, by the reaction I've gotten to these two series I've been writing. The first one ended up being 5 parts, and that was about how the Middle East and Israel have more or less completely lost it since the days of JFK, and how really it's kind of a tragedy. The title of that series is The Debacle of the Middle East versus JFK. That was a 5-part series, and that's what really started gathering steam and coming to my Substack site. And like I said, the traffic to my Substack site has tripled since I started this. You know, nothing I've ever written has even come close to what I've done with this. Okay. Now, I followed that up with a series that I'm working on now. It's called Israel Attacks America, the Liberty Incident. And that's kept up this flow to my site. So what I want to talk a little bit about this evening is let's talk about the first series. I started this off by going about how disappointed I was with both Biden and Trump on the Middle East, okay? And if anything, I would say Trump is even worse than Biden was. He closed the PLO office in Washington, D.C. He canceled nearly all American aid to the West Bank and Gaza, as well as $360 million in yearly aid given to the United Nations for Palestinian refugees. Okay? Then, of course, there was that incredible statement that he made in February of this year. Gaza will be given to the United States by Israel after the war, and this will involve the permanent relocation of the Palestinians. He said that Gaza should be cleaned out, and we should send the Palestinians to Egypt and Jordan. And then he topped that with he was going to make Gaza into a beautiful new land and rebuild the Strip as a Riviera for the people of the world. You know, I wish that none of that was true, but I hate to say it, but all of it is true. Now, did anybody ask the Palestinians the way they felt about that? No, of course not. It's like the Palestinians don't exist. You know, well, I hate to tell Donald, but they actually do exist. All right. Okay. And this has been a very serious, I believe, foreign policy blight on the United States for a long time now. All right. And, you know, everybody complains about the terrorism that the PLO had done, but people forget that's the way the Israeli state was established. There were two organizations, one called Stern and the other one was called Irgun, and they specialized in assassinations and terrorist bombings. The goal was to get the British and the Palestinians out of Palestine, which was a mandate at that time, so that the Zionists could move in and create this state called Israel. There's the very famous bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946 that killed 91 people. There was the massacre at Deir Yassin in 1948, which killed at least 107 Palestinians. Now, this was all part of a plan, okay, which was overseen by people like David Ben-Gurion and Menachem Begin, who later became prime ministers of Israel. It was called Plan Dalet. The idea was to create a wave of terror, which also included another hidden massacre at a place called Tantura. All right. This eventually became part of the Nakba, all right, which was the war by the Zionist forces against the Palestinians and some of the Arab countries that tried to step in and protect them, all right? Now, what I said earlier is absolutely true, that some of these men later became prime ministers in Israel. David Ben-Gurion was one, Menachem Begin was another. Now, Begin founded a new party called the Likud, which dominates the Israeli political spectrum today. Another prime minister, Shamir, he was also one of these guys. But it was under Begin, of course, that the invasion of Lebanon took place in 1982, and two more massacres took place at Sabra and Shatila. After Begin resigned, Shamir took over leadership of the Likud. He became prime minister, and Benjamin Netanyahu comes from Likud. Now, what I should say here is that in the a turning point, a very powerful turning point in Israeli history took place with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. That, I believe, was in 1995. Now, that essentially, well, let me preface this. Benjamin Netanyahu polarized the Israeli electorate. He actually put up placards of Rabin in a Nazi uniform with crosshairs over his face. Then he arranged a mock funeral for Rabin with a coffin and a hangman's noose. His followers chanted "Death to Rabin" when this mock funeral was taking place. Now, this, things like that could have only encouraged somebody in the extreme to go ahead and pull off the assassination of Rabin. And that's what happened.
But, you know, this opposition came because he was one of the guys really trying to push for a solution, a peace.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh,
see, the reason I believe that this happened, okay, was because Rabin was one of the authors and he was also one of the backers of the Oslo Accords. And that was supposed to be a basis for solving the Palestinian problem, which included, at the beginning, giving them a piece of land, and then seeing how that worked, and then expanding it later, okay, giving them rights, etc. Because what they had back then was essentially a system of apartheid, all right? The Palestinians were like third-rate citizens, and they were, as many people said, Gaza was simply an open-air concentration camp, or a prison, whatever you want to call it. All right, so Rabin was trying to create a solution to this. But Likud and Netanyahu were not going to have any of that. And so they demonized him. And the inevitable result was that one of the Likud followers, a young man named Yigal Amir, went ahead and shot him. Now, let me ask you something, Len. Do you remember a guy named Barry Chamish?
Not really. Remind me.
Barry Chamish wrote a very interesting book. He passed away a few years ago. But he was a Jewish guy who was not a Zionist, lived up in Canada. He wrote a book called Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin? And if you want to see something very eye-opening, that is a very interesting book. I read it because my publisher at Feral House at that time published it. It's a provocative book. I'm not sure he proves everything that he's saying, okay, but it's definitely worth a read. Now, there was another guy who also thought there was something more to the assassination of Rabin, and that was John Kennedy Jr. He arranged for a combination interview article about the Rabin case for his magazine, George. And the main source was Amir's mother. No one else touched the article. He made sure of that. And she posited that her son had been manipulated by the Shin Bet, which was Israel's version of the FBI. Now, let me say this. Barry agreed with that, except he goes much further in his theory about the crime. Now, here's my question. Why would he be so interested in this case? You know, well, maybe it's because his mother demanded that he be privately tutored about what his father was really all about. And I like didn't know this till I started writing this article. Jackie Kennedy had Pierre Salinger stay at her house for over a month, and she requested that he spend 90 minutes each day telling her kids about John F. Kennedy's real foreign policy and his president. I had no idea that that ever happened. But that's very, very informative. Now, clearly, Jackie Kennedy didn't know what happened to JFK, because we know about the whole story from David Talbot's book, Brothers, about the message that Jackie and RFK sent to the Kremlin about there being a larger conspiracy and that Johnson would not be able to continue JFK's foreign policy, but RFK would resign run for office, then run for the president. So we know that Jackie knew what happened to her husband. Now, I think I talked a little bit about this before. John F. Kennedy Jr. collected and read books about the assassination of his father. One of his girlfriends, Meg Ozzone, actually wrote that his goal was to run for political office and bring the people involved in the assassination and the cover-up to justice. So what this meant to me is that JFK Jr. understood what his father was doing in the Middle East. That's probably why he took such an interest in the assassination of Rabin. All right. So I used that as a jumping off point for this five-part series, that Kennedy, his foreign policy in the Middle East diverged from what came before and what came after, as we have so many examples of this. Okay, Vietnam, Indonesia, Congo. Well, here's another one, the Middle East. One of the very first things that JFK told McGeorge Bundy was that he wanted to make a relationship with Gamal Abdel Nasser one of his top priorities for his presidency, which is amazing in and of itself. Okay, because John Foster Dulles wanted to marginalize Nasser. He thought he was getting too powerful. He was getting too charismatic. And so towards the end of the Eisenhower administration, they went ahead and cut off funding for the Aswan Dam, and they turned to Saudi Arabia to be their new partner in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia and Egypt under Nasser were completely different, which for reasons which I'll get into later. But I think it's important to realize that a couple of other reasons that John Foster Dulles did this is that he wanted Nasser to join the Baghdad Pact, which later became CENTO, all right? This was one of the alliance systems that he set up. Dulles set up to ring the world. Nasser wouldn't join, okay? And then there was also the fact that he recognized Red China. That was another reason that Dulles turned on him. But we should not forget that in 1956, when France, England, and Israel invaded Egypt, Eisenhower was furious because Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister of England, had not alerted him to this. And so he sent Dulles up to the UN, where he got a General Assembly resolution against the invasion. And Eisenhower insisted that A, it stop, and B, Israel not occupy the land it had invaded. This is very, very different than what we're going to see with Johnson. Now, John F. Kennedy, Senator John F. Kennedy, was very disappointed in all of this. And he said during the 1960 campaign, "We have lost ground in Africa because we have neglected and ignored the needs and the aspirations of the African people, because we failed to foresee the emergence of Africa and ally ourselves with the causes of independence." All right, this is one of his big themes, was Africa. We had to back African independence. Now, of course, Israel was opposed to this, because in addition to that 1956 invasion, Israel had tried to overthrow Nasser in 1954 through something called, that we term today, the Levant Affair. This is when they sent in these young Jewish kids, gave them false IDs, etc., and had them carry out a series of bombings in Alexandria and Cairo to destabilize Egypt, all right? And although it ended up being blamed on Defense Minister Levon, it was later revealed that the conspiracy went up to the highest levels. In other words, Ben-Gurion was in on it. This is how much they feared Nasser. Now, on the other hand, Kennedy liked Nasser because, number one, he was a socialist. He wanted to try and equalize the maldistribution of wealth in Egypt, okay? Number two, he was a secularist. He was not an Islamic fundamentalist, which Kennedy was against. And number three, he was a pan-Arabist. He thought that the Arab countries in the Middle East should arrange themselves in a confederacy. And in fact, he did unite with Syria for about 2 or 3 years, called the United Arab Republic. He believed that the oil underneath the ground in the Middle East belonged to all the Arabs. And he wanted to build roads and highways and schools and hospitals. And this was part of his tremendous appeal in the Middle East. All right, and this is why Israel feared him. See, Nasser had two enemies, Israel and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia thought that he was going to take away, if he went ahead and realized his pan-Arab plan, that he would take away the oil from them and outlaw Islamic fundamentalism. This is why they had sent their agents, the Muslim Brotherhood, to try and kill him. They tried to kill Nasser twice. All right. Now, Kennedy looked upon Nasser as a man who could transform the Middle East. He could westernize and modernize the Middle East. And he was very cognizant that the Palestinians, he considered them as Arabs, and Egypt should stand up for them. Whereas, of course, the Israelis, like, for example, Ben-Gurion wrote in his diary that the Palestinian refugees should never be allowed to return to Israel. And then he wrote a letter to his son, "We must expel Arabs and take their place." See, Kennedy didn't buy that stuff. He was for the Joseph Johnson plan, which was, I think, didn't Monica talk about this last week?
Well, it's in the article and in her books, but...
Yeah, right. The Johnson plan allowed for the repatriation of the Palestinians. In other words, they should allow themselves the option of going back to where they were or going elsewhere, and the UN should pay for it. In addition to that, there was the whole problem of the American Zionist Council, okay? This was a group that, in reality, was a foreign country's extension in America. Now, that if you do that, you're supposed to register as a foreign lobbyist, and they didn't want to do it. And so Robert Kennedy began a lawsuit against that, and realizing the writing was on the wall, the guys involved in that group started organizing something called IPAC, because they knew that sooner or later the American Zionist Council was going to be going out of business. Well, Kennedy pursued the lawsuit, but then his brother was assassinated, and Johnson reversed that policy, just like he forgot all about the refugee plan. Okay. He recognized IPAC and gave them a income tax exemption dating back to 1953. See, Kennedy, when he was a very young man, visited Palestine in 1939, and he wrote a very perceptive letter to his father, which he closed out by saying, "Palestine was hardly Britain's to give away." Let me say that again. Palestine was hardly Britain's to give away. And he noted, "The country has been Arabic for the last few hundred years, and that's where the sympathies are." And this is 1939. Okay, now, another dispute between Kennedy and Israel was the whole issue of, in addition to Nasser, in addition to the AZC, in addition to the Palestinian refugees, there was Dimona. This was where the Israelis were secretly building an atomic bomb, and they lied to Kennedy about it more than once. But Kennedy had been alerted by the French that, no, that is not a peaceful use of the bomb going on. That is the creation of an atomic weapon. Okay, now, no president since the Trinity test was more anti-nuke proliferation than John F. Kennedy was. He was adamant about this. And he was furious that everybody was lying to him. This was Shimon Peres, David Ben-Gurion, Abba Ibn, and Golda Meir. They were all lying to him. And he was very angry about this. And so he came to a conclusion, the only thing these guys will understand, if I pull funding. And so that's what he did. Around June 15th, of 1963, he sent a warning to Ben-Gurion. And then Ben-Gurion resigned. Levi Eshkol came in, and Kennedy did the same thing with him. Now, eventually he got an agreement. But eventually, of course, he was killed. But let me add one other thing. There's a really good book by Roger Mattson, which I reviewed for Bob Perry. I think the title of it was Stealing the Atom Bomb. He makes a very good case that the highly enriched uranium that was used at Dimona actually came from the United States. And in fact, Carl Duckett, who was the technical expert for the CIA, when they got a sample of this years later, he told Richard Helms, this stuff came from America. It came from a plant called NUMEC, Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, that was located just north of Pittsburgh in a little town called Apollo. In his very fine book, Mattson eventually reveals that the board of directors of NUPEC was really more or less a front for the Mossad. And they shipped approximately 200 kilograms of highly enriched uranium out of that plant to Israel. And this is the stuff that they very likely used for the creation of their atomic bomb. This is how much Kennedy's policy was reversed, which is absolutely incredible. Now, when Johnson comes in, I mean, you're not gonna tell me that Johnson wasn't aware of JFK's Middle East policy. Again, he shifts it. Number one, he froze out Nasser. Nasser understood, by the way, that the policy was being changed almost immediately, within 6 months of Johnson in the White House. And so I think it's by 1966, Nasser broke relations with the United States. Johnson, his father and grandfather belonged to something called the Christadelphian Churches, a very rare religion that minimizes the New Testament in lieu of the Old Testament. Therefore, it concentrates a lot on the Jewish figures that are located there. That system held that Christ was a Jewish Messiah, and that when he returned to earth, he would set up a kingdom to fulfill the promises of Abraham and David, and Israel will be the center of it. Johnson liked to tell his Jewish audiences, quote, "My Christian faith sprang from yours." His aunt, Jessie Hatcher, was a member of the Zionist Organization of America. And then there was a story put out that Johnson was like an earlier version of Schindler, that he brought in these Jewish refugees into Texas and put them at the National Youth Administration camps. Claudia Anderson, who was the archivist at the LBJ Library, has said, "I've never been able to find any evidence. It is at least very much exaggerated." Okay. Johnson was against what Eisenhower did during the Suez Crisis of 1956. All right. He didn't like the fact that Eisenhower was going to make the Israelis pull out of their conquered territories. All right. Now, Johnson became the best friend the Jewish state has ever had in the White House. Okay, or as Donald Neff said, after Kennedy's death, a sea change was about to take place in America's relations with Israel. Up to Johnson's presidency, no administration had been as completely pro-Israel and anti-Arab as his. That's all true. All right, that's all true. Okay, no president had ushered the Prime Minister of Israel into the White House until Johnson did with Levi Eshkol in June of 1964. All right, no American president ever shipped offensive weapons to Israel before. In the fiscal year 1966, Johnson authorized $92 million worth of military assistance to Israel, which would be about $1 billion today, which was more than the cumulative total of all military aid given to Israel going back to Truman. All right. And also there was included a proxy sale through West Germany. The sum total was something like at least 250 M48 tanks and 48 Skyhawk jets. And so now the policy in Israel, led by Shimon Peres as one of the advocates, was it was time to go on the offensive instead of the defensive. And I believe that this was caused by the Johnson administration. Myra Amit was a director of the Mossad in 1967. Myra Amit and James Angleton had planned for the attack upon Egypt and three other Arab countries months in advance. In fact, Angleton was collecting information on where Nasser's planes would be so that the Israeli Air Force could hit them. But the Israelis feared that they would not be able to hold the occupied territories after. It would be a repeat of 1956. So Mr. Amit went to Washington. He had a meeting with Angleton. Angleton arranged a meeting with Helms at the CIA. And then McNamara, Secretary of Defense, met with the chief of the Mossad. Johnson got on the phone. McNamara had two questions. How long would it take? The answer was about a week. How many casualties would there be? The answer was less than in the 1948 war. McNamara then told him he was free to go home. Okay? Now, Johnson tried to make like he was shocked by all this on the day of the Israeli, which I think was June the 5th, 1967. But there was an emergency shipment of armored personnel carriers, spare parts for tanks, spare parts for Hawk missile air defense, bomb fuses, and artillery ammo and gas masks that went out on May the 23rd. How could that not be approved by Johnson and McNamara, all right? And by the way, Arthur Krim, who was a big-time entertainment lawyer in Hollywood, his wife was Matilda Krim. They were very close friends with Johnson. Arthur Krim actually monitored that shipment and telling Johnson about its progress. So I don't buy that this was a complete surprise to LBJ. Okay, now also, Arthur Goldberg, who was Johnson's ambassador to the UN, delayed a ceasefire because he did not want Israel labeled as the aggressor or for withdrawal from the occupied territories. That was a deliberate stall. What Johnson was doing was reversing something that Kennedy wholly subscribed to, which was a 1950 tripartite declaration that no country in the Middle East would expand its territorial status quo from the 1949 Arab-Israeli armistice agreement. And so this was the ultimate end of that tripartite agreement signed on to, and actually, I believe, encouraged by Lyndon Johnson, who more than one person has said was the greatest advocate for Israel up to that time. See, Kennedy had met with Golda Meir in December of 1962 down in Florida, and he listened to the usual Israeli plea. They were so vulnerable, the Arabs hated them, and the Russians were backing Nasser. So Kennedy took this all in stride with a giant grain of salt, and he told her that the best way I can have influence in the Middle East is being fair to both sides. So I have to develop relationships so I can have some influence with the Arab countries, okay? And then I could bring that to bear on certain situations so Israel would not be seriously compromised. Here's a quote. If we pulled out of the Arab Middle East and maintained our ties only with Israel, that would not be in Israel's interest. And he went ahead and said certain things that Israel did that made it hard for him to approve of what they were doing. This is like cross-border raids in Syria and their refusal to countenance the Palestinian refugee problem. All right? Now, he also said something at that meeting, which was, I believe, slowly but surely eroded. He said there was a difference between America's security interests and Israel's. Let me repeat that. He said that there was a difference between America's security interests and Israel's. And he said, our security problems are therefore just as great as Israel's. We have to concern ourselves with the whole Middle East. I mean, can you imagine somebody saying that to an Israeli leader today? It just wouldn't happen. And so he said he had to make it crystal clear that the U.S. meant what it said in the Tripartite Declaration of 1950, that we will act promptly and decisively against any nation in the Middle East which attacks its neighbor. To say that Johnson broke with that does not even really begin to describe the actual schism that took place. He obliterated the tripartite agreement. And this is why I think Nasser was so heartbroken when he got the news that Kennedy was dead, because he knew that things were now going to change, and change rapidly. Give you an example, and I've given some examples already, but about Dimona. When Johnson got the news that Israel had the bomb, Richard Helms told him, he said, don't tell anybody. Can you imagine Kennedy saying something like that? It was just a reversal of what really happened, okay? Now, Johnson was also subject, like I mentioned before, some very strong Zionist influences, like former Rabbi Abe Feinberg, who was a lobbyist for Israel, and Matilda and Arthur Krim, okay? And he actually listened to these people. In fact, the Krims had a room at the White House. They later built an estate, which was a helicopter ride away from Johnson's ranch. As unpopular as Johnson was in 1968, at the New Year's celebration of 1968, the Krims were there singing songs with him. During the Six-Day War, the Krims were with Johnson. She was writing him memos during the war, okay? And one of them said that he should not make the Israelis withdraw from the conquered territories. I mean, can you imagine Kennedy doing something like that? I mean, it's just, you know, unfathomable. All right, but what happened was Johnson set a new paradigm with this inseparability between the United States and Israel. And what happened was that Nixon, Kissinger, and Gerald Ford went ahead and followed that paradigm. I don't think there's any question about that. And in fact, Ford and Kissinger promised Israel aid at about $2 billion per year in an agreement that went on for 5 years. All right, the USA would now, and let me quote, make every effort to be fully responsive of an ongoing long-term basis to Israel's military equipment and other defense requirements, to its energy requirements, and to its economic needs. In other words, we became the sugar daddy to Israel. All right? And that goes on to this day. It's over $3 billion a year, more than any other country by far.
$3 billion a year?
Yes. If it wasn't for us, the Israeli economy would collapse. All right.
Unbelievable.
Now, that's my I just gave you a summary of the first five, the debacle, the Middle East versus JFK.
Yeah.
So the next time I'm on, I'll have the Liberty incident done. But let me answer some letters.
I just have one question here because
what?
I just want to know. What was the quote you used about, was LBJ Israel's greatest supporter, or how did you put it?
That was in, he became the greatest president to back Israel up to that time. That was in a book by a guy named Tibnon, and his book title was called The Lobby, describing the influence of the Israeli lobby in the United States. Yes.
Yeah.
He's an expert on the issue, and that's okay. What he said.
And reversing JFK, right?
Yes. Yeah, every book I read said that Johnson completely broke with Kennedy's policies there. All right, let's go to some letters. I'm very sorry about this, but Len has had such great guests on. you know, that he really didn't need me for a while. Okay. June the 30th, Bill Bretsch, Naples, Florida. Recently, I listened to the program with John Washburn. He mentioned that many of the witnesses in Dealey Plaza thought one of the early shots sounded like a firecracker. Could a shot from a silenced rifle hit the front windshield of the limo and sound like a firecracker, on impact? A test could be made about this. This could have been, you know, and I, you know, that's a really good point, and that's a definite possibility. See, I've always believed that there were silencers used in the assassination. I've always believed that, okay? And so what he's talking about here, you know, a silenced rifle from the front that sounded like a firecracker, okay, that would be a definite possibility. I don't think anybody's ever tested that, though, unfortunately. Okay, P.J. Orshak. All right. Hi, Jim. This is July the 8th. You wrote a brief, nice appreciation of Joan Mellon at the Education Forum. I reread your review of Mellon's book on Garrison from 2006. I have to say that it was a fair review, as it was a very difficult book to read, organizational and writing issues for sure. But I did appreciate the summary of her major findings that you listed in your review. I hope that you and Len address her contributions. Well, you did that, right? You had two guests on talking about Joan Mellon.
Right, and I also played a clip of hers, one of the good interviews that she did over the years. She was on 17 times.
Wow.
Yeah. But she had many different topics, you know, Cuba, Our Man in Haiti, and the last one, Catfished, and various things.
All right. A couple of questions. Have you revised your opinion on Mellon's book about Garrison for good or ill? Yes, I have. I think it's a better book than what I originally talked about. All right. Secondly, I am seeing a number of people online who are still dismissive of Garrison and his investigation, especially with regard to Clay Shaw. Have you changed your view of the Shaw prosecution at all? No, I haven't. And I'm going to talk about that due to another question. And I think that those people are wrong. All right.
Yeah, or they're trolls, or, you know.
Yeah, that could be it.
They're on some USAID payroll because you point out their errors and they just jump around and then they keep going back to the same thing. I mean,
yes.
It reminds me of criticism, you know, Garrison or Prouty or things like that. They, oh, he did this, he did that. Then you point out, no, he didn't. This is not true. It's not true. I knew the man, you know. And then, yeah, it's just, it's really telling. And it used to be a great example was John McAdams, when he would just lose a debate on something. And then a month later, start the same thing up again.
When right.
You know, you go, hey, we already answered this. You're just there to try to trick people new to the case.
You know what Lisa said about him? She said, look, I would go head to head with McAdams, prove he's wrong. And then 2 weeks later, he would pop up at a different forum saying the same thing that I just defeated him on. Okay.
Yeah.
That was John McAdams for you.
Yeah. But he did have one supporter, which made a lot of good points. And that guy was named Paul Nolan.
Why don't you deliver the punchline?
Yeah, that was his alias. He had a
right.
You know, he went, and I'm sure that like on the other Matt Dowitz forum, there's all these different guys that have got different names. They're all patting each other on the back, and they would not be surprised to find out it's just all, you know.
Well, you know how that was exposed,
because constantly,
a guy with the real name of Paul Nolan showed up and said, "Wait a minute, I'm Paul Nolan. Who's this guy using my name?"
Oh, is he a jet propulsion expert or something he claimed to be?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
exactly,
yeah. Yeah, but, you know, McAdams had no shame, and these guys have no shame. It's one thing to be wrong about something. And, you know, for instance, let's pick something. They say the Zapruder film's been tampered and the car actually stopped, and it doesn't show that. Someday there'll be a way to prove that the car slowed down, the brake lights came on, or every other car after that did stop, but Kennedy's, just briefly, and then goes, you can make the case, but it didn't stop for like 30 seconds, and or one way or the other, and as long as people are good enough to change their mind on something, it did happen, it didn't happen, now we can prove it. And like you mentioned several times, photographic evidence is so hard to back up. Like, is that Lee Oswald in the doorway, or is there a what's his name? It's just hard to tell, and you can make you can make your best case for it. But after all, if you don't believe Lee Oswald had anything to do with it, or Lovelady or whatever, then anyway.
All right, now here's a kind of follow-up. Mike Luce, July the 11th. I hope this is reaching Jim DiEugenio. I recently saw a comment you made in the Education Forum thread on Joan Mellon. I was curious what backup you have on it. This is the quote. He called Andrews and told him to go to Dallas to defend Oswald, a point which Andrews secretly admitted to Weisberg. And Shaw himself later admitted he knew Oswald and knew he was a double agent, end quote. I'm curious where you have Shaw saying that about Oswald. For what it's worth, I've always been suspicious of how much Shaw knew and when, but would love to be persuaded. Thanks for all you do. There's an article I wrote. Well, there's two segments here. The one is about Andrews admitting Shaw is the guy who called him, and that's in an unpublished book by Harold Weisberg, which Martin Hay dug up. I think it was in chapter 5 of that book where he revealed this conversation he had with Dean Andrews, and Andrews swore him to secrecy until after he died, which Weisberg kept. Now, the other thing about Shaw saying that stuff about Oswald is in an article I wrote called Sylvia Marr and Clay Shaw versus Jim Garrison. There, through a guy named Doug Caddy, I found out about someone who had met Clay Shaw in New Orleans. I believe it was like 1969 or 1970. And he admitted this to him because the Garrison prosecution was over. And that's in that article. I interviewed this guy for about an hour, and you can look it up on Kennedy's and King. Sylvia Marr and Clay Shaw versus Jim Garrison is the title of the article. All right, July the 17th, Bob Reed. I'm a longtime admirer of your work and owner of several of your books. I just read your review of Grodin's Absolute Proof, and in particular, your analysis of the Black Dog Man image. You postulate that the image suggests a shape not behind the stockade fence, but behind the retaining wall. It has been well established that there was a young black couple seated on the bench, which was behind the wall, eating lunch and watching the motorcade. Jeff Morley has a piece on this. Okay. Do you not think Black Dog Man was actually just that black man or woman watching the motorcade and are reacting to the shots? I do. I did some work on this, knowing I was going to address that question. And I went back and looked at Jeff's stuff on this, and he's calling for witnesses because I think the best witness that they were there is a woman named Marilyn Sitzman, who, of course, was a secretary to Zapruder. Okay? And she remembered them being there. Okay? And she's a pretty good witness. And she told Tink Thompson about this. All right. I went back and looked at the photographs in Grodin's book. And although I'm not ready to say with, say, like 90% certainty that Bob Reed is right about this, there's a good possibility that he is. Okay, reviewing the situation. Now, again, I have to say, I've never been and never claimed to be an expert on the photographs. All right. But I would say that it's more than a 50% chance that he's right about that issue. All right. July the 23rd. Jim Conley. Thanks. I don't know. I don't have the first part of this. Thanks again, Jim. I will likely become a paid member at Kennedy's and King and make a donation. Hoping to see you at a conference. Maybe get a couple books signed there. Didn't see you on the Lancer list for this year. Why isn't the media asking both Trump and Pompeo the content of their conversation during his first term? That's a really great question. Did Pompeo intimidate Trump into not declassifying the records on the JFK case during his first term? I think there's a lot of evidence that says that's true. Then what I believed happened, and again, I'm not sure about this. I believe that Bobby Kennedy Jr. made a deal with Trump during the campaign leading up to the 2024 election. I believe that he said that I will endorse you if you agree to declassify the records on the JFK, RFK, and King case. That's what I think changed Trump's mind. I believe that's what happened, and that's why we got the executive order. And thank God for the Luna Committee, okay, that is backing up all of that, all right? Okay, Joe Aquino, July the 26th, 2025. Do you still believe that Fletcher Prouty was the real deal when it comes to JFK? I was watching America's Untold Stories on YouTube, and they basically said that Prouty was a fraud. Is this, well, let me say this. There were two things that Fletcher Prouty was responsible for in Oliver Stone's film JFK, and that was the very strange lack of military intelligence support for the Secret Service in Dallas. That was number one. Number two, he was responsible for the withdrawal program from Vietnam. That was such an important part of that film. In fact, I would say it was probably the most important part of that film because America had not been exposed to that before. Well, both of those turned out to be accurate. And I wrote an article about this called Fletcher Prouty versus the ARB, based on the work of the wonderful British researcher, Malcolm Blunt. He dug out a lot of stuff that concerned this issue, the smearing of Fletcher Prouty. And this was a deliberate attempt by several people on the review board. And I wrote this article called Fletcher Prouty versus the ARB. Because people like Fred Litwin were using that interview to go ahead and smear Fletcher Prouty. All right, and I did some work on this, including an interview with Len Osanek about this issue. All right, so no, I believe that Fletcher Prouty made two valuable contributions to Oliver Stone's film, and they have both been proved by the test of time. Okay. And I'm really glad I wrote this article because it kind of shows you that there were certain people in the review board that shouldn't have been there, that they had a bias towards the lone assassin theory from the beginning. And one of the people I interviewed was Doug Horn, okay, about this issue. It's a very important issue, I believe. All right, so no, I don't believe that at all. And I have to say, Mark Gruber is the guy who is the main voice for America's Untold Stories. I like Mark personally. He's a good guy. But somebody emailed me and said, Jim, watch this show that they did about William Harvey. So I did. And I was really taken aback by this show because it tried to make out Bill Harvey to be a kind of unsung hero in history. That is not who Bill Harvey was. Bill Harvey was in charge of two assassination programs. One was ZR Rifle, in which he collected thieves, convicts, and killers from abroad to do dirty deeds for the CIA. And one of the, it was Harvey who recruited QJ Nguyen and WI Rogue. Both those guys went to the Congo, and they were trying to assassinate Patrice Lumumba. All right? I don't see how you can be an unsung hero and run a program like that. Because Kennedy was backing Lumumba, you know, until he was killed. All right? In addition to that, Bill Harvey ran the second phase of the Castro assassination plots. He teamed up with Johnny Rosselli, the famous mobster from Chicago, LA, and Vegas, to try and do away with Castro. All right, now, if you read the declassified CIA Inspector General report, you will understand that the CIA lied to Bobby Kennedy about this. All right, they said, when they finally told him about the first phase of the plots, they said, "We're sorry about that. It's been completely cut off. There will be no such thing anymore." Bobby Kennedy made a mistake, and he believed these guys. They even said right in the report, more or less, that the CIA was lying, that Harvey had now been assigned to Rosselli, and they were continuing the plots, being supplied with equipment by Ted Shackley out of JM Wave. Now, Mark actually said something that was really startling to me. See, what happened is that at the end of the missile crisis, Harvey was like mounting the hardliners. He wanted an all-out attack on Cuba. All right. And he said things like, you know, if you wouldn't have hesitated before, meaning the Bay of Pigs, we wouldn't have this problem right now. He then, at the near the conclusion of the negotiations, he sent in a commando crew. He made the order to send in a commando crew into Cuba. When Bobby Kennedy found out about this, he was shocked, okay, because this would have upset the whole thing that he and his brother had worked so hard for 2 weeks to settle this thing peacefully. And Mark tried to imply somehow that that was not unauthorized. Well, then why did Bobby Kennedy demand that he be fired, that Harvey be fired? All right. Well, Richard Helms protected Harvey, and he sent him to Rome, and he became the station chief in Rome. Now, there's a problem with this. That's where Permandex was. That was the home of Permandex Centro Mundial Comercial, you know, Clay Shaw's outfit, who, if you read Mikhail Mehta's book, in addition to the assassination attempts on de Gaulle, Permandex was accused of killing Mate, the great liberal oil magnate who wanted to supply places like North Africa with cheap imported oil. Well, there was an interview that Mikhail Mehta uncovered in which a journalist who was studying Mate's life said that he came to the conclusion it was Permandex that killed him. Secondly, this is where Gladio was. Italy was the center of Gladio, all right? This was the so-called stay-behind operations that NATO arranged in case there was a communist invasion of West Europe, and also to battle the Communist Party in Italy.
Okay? In upcoming elections.
Right, exactly, correct. And the CIA intervened, and almost every day backed the so-called social democrats against the socialists and the communists. Now, Kennedy was convinced by Arthur Schlesinger of a policy called L'Apertura, which was openness. And then he went to Italy in 1962, and he endorsed that the social democrats should unite with the socialists, all right, the socialist party. They should bring them into for a coalition. So sending Harvey to Rome was not such a good idea. And then, of course, there's the information in David Talbot's last book, The Devil's Chessboard, that William Harvey was in Dallas a week before the Kennedy assassination. So I strongly disagree that Bill Harvey should be made out to be some kind of unsung hero. A lot of the people who worked with him thought he was a little nuts. Okay? So anyway, that's my reply to Joe Aquino. I think Fletcher Prouty was... I mean, if you can show me something he told Oliver Stone that he was wrong about, go ahead.
That whole 15-minute clip is like almost the highlight of the film.
Yeah, you're talking about the walk with Sutherland and Costner from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument, right?
Yeah, and then Fletcher discusses, look, this is what we did in my time there. And then he's saying, look, you're closer than you think. You got to keep going because you're on to something. And I'm just here to let you know that. And that's, you know, just part of the film. But if you read the great book that is from David Ratcliffe, Understanding Special Operations, that comes from interviews with Fletcher, or there's many video interviews up even on the web now. I collected everything I could of Fletcher's onto CD, which was the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, all about his background, all about his various careers. As a matter of fact, I should say that me and Jeff Carter did a documentary. It's called Fletcher Prouty's Cold War, and it's out on Vimeo. And Oliver Stone saw it and wrote a very glowing note to me. About that,
it is good.
Yeah, it is good. So there is a good documentary about Fletcher Prouty. You know, you can agree or disagree, but all his
wasn't that shown at a conference.
Yeah, it was just shown last week in Washington D.C. On a film festival, and Jeff is entering it all over the place. I haven't kept up to date on how many things it's in, but. Yeah, so it's being shown around, and I think it's like on demand. I think it's like $6. You know, you rent it and you get it for like a weekend or something, so you can watch it as you know many times as you want for that. Or I'm not sure, but inexpensively, like to watch. So if anybody's interested in Fletcher Prouty, they can just watch that. And there's a good biography, a good documentary about where he was and when he says he was here and what his orders were. And I'm going to make a little clip because I have that video clip of Malcolm Blunt discussing that, was saying he feels really bad that when he's looked into it, he didn't realize how crooked the guys calling people from the Pentagon, and they intercepted their emails, and they were, you know, the con was on before they even had a couple of the people there to testify. They were setting up how we're going to set them up and make it the whole thing look bad.
I agree. I totally. Malcolm did some very good work on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last letter, August the 11th. Andrew Schlick. Mr. DiEugenio, first allow me to say that your clarity, eloquence, and ability to guide an audience from premise to conclusion are unparalleled. I regularly listen to your podcast appearances and share them with friends. Your ability to synthesize complex historical threads into coherent, compelling narratives is extraordinary. My understanding is you have a background in teaching, and I can only imagine the privilege of being your student. Please continue your work. It is invaluable. To my question, while Mr. Jefferson Morley's work on the cover-up has been excellent and essential, I feel that this approach has left significant gaps regarding the crime itself. Many crucial elements remain unaddressed in the public narrative, and you have spoken to many of these pieces over the years. Do you anticipate being able to expand your public testimony or written work to more fully reconstruct the crime beyond what you have already presented? The way I see it, this was nothing less than a coup d'etat. One whose architects we know and remain shielded, given that the structures they established still influence power today. The evidence, in my view, is neither obscure nor difficult to piece together, yet the national conversation has not moved to a full reckoning. Well, that might be changing a little bit with the Luna Committee and also this guy named Burleson, Eric Burleson, who's another congressman. He came out for a new investigation of the JFK case, and that story made it a little bit into the MSM. Okay, so let me get back to his letter. I believe this history is central to restoring democratic integrity, even if I also recognize that many citizens burdened with daily concerns may dismiss it as too far gone to address. People who live through it often tell me there's nothing to be done now. I strongly disagree. I believe it is one of the most consequential and untold truths in modern history. Let me add again. Luna was on the Joe Rogan show, and that gets millions of viewers. So we are making a little bit of headway. I am 42 years old, back to the letter, have listened to all of your podcast appearances, and have reviewed the photographic evidence closely enough to be certain, beyond a reasonable doubt, of what occurred that day. My question to you is, how can I best contribute to this effort, and how can we ensure this history is not once again buried in a few years' time, dismissed as an unfortunate but settled chapter? Your work is a service not only to historical truth, but to civic understanding. You illuminate events that have shaped the trajectory of our nation in ways most cannot grasp without guidance. Please continue, as you are making an enduring impact. What are the next chokeholds that can be pursued by this committee to lock everything down? Mr. Morley has done a terrific job in one area, but I wish you could lead it now. With deep respect, Andrew. By the way, that's not a fake letter. I didn't write it. Okay, although it sounds like my PR guy did, you know, if I had a PR guy. Well, first of all, thank you so much for that letter. It is very much appreciated. Now, as to, I also agree that it was a coup d'etat. And I also agree that there are certain things that Jeff Morley should address. But I think Jeff only wants to go so far because it would probably limit his access, okay, which is the only guy we have out there right now, okay, with that kind of access to the MSM. One of the things I've tried to concentrate on, which Morley does not, is the changes in foreign policy, okay, which to me signal that it was a coup d'etat. All right, tonight I talked about the Middle East. There's also Indonesia. There's also Vietnam. There's also Congo. There's also Dominican Republic. All right, and we went into some of these with JFK Revisited, especially the long version, the four-hour version of that film. That's one way I also think that there should be more attention paid to what Oswald was doing in New Orleans and the roles of Ruth and Michael Payne, which was gone into in that film, The Assassination and Mrs. Payne by Max Good. So these are all things that I figure in. Now, Jeff has done a very good job on the Gelonides files, and he seems to think that James Angleton was the guy in charge. I tend to lean towards Alan Dulles, and that's what we try to do with JFK Revisited, because I believe Alan Dulles would have been the natural connecting point. Because what we did in that film is we brought in the probability of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, especially through Curtis LeMay, influencing the JFK autopsy. So those are some of the things that I think should be accented, all right, to actually outline that a coup d'etat did take place. Now, as to your question, is how, what can, look, what we have going right now is this Burleson guy and the Luna Committee. In reality, those are the political inputs that we have. I would do everything I could to support those two people. And it's great that Luna got on the Joe Rogan show, because Joe Rogan is one of the very few people who has a big audience, a very big audience, and will address this issue. Okay. Although, Len, you had Jimmy Dore on, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I interviewed Jimmy Dore.
Okay. That might be another outlet, somebody you can write to or email. Okay, and request that he have somebody on. might be me, it might be somebody else. So that's where I think we should be pushing right now, because I think Congresswoman Luna is actually, against all the odds, is actually making some headway. She had two good hearings. The first one with me, Oliver, and Morley. The second one with Dr. Rust, with Dan Hardway, John Tonheim, and Doug Horn. And those have gotten a lot of exposure. Those two hearings brought to bear information that had never been presented before to Congress. So this is an important development, and we should be pushing this as far as we can, talking about it, writing, etc., asking places in the MSM to cover this more thoroughly. Okay? You know, those are some of the things that we can do. And those are some of the things I think we should be doing. Now, again, this is going to take a very strong effort. All right, but it's places like this, you know, Black Op Radio, all right, places like Jeff Morley's JFK Facts, all right, that we can try and bring to bear, okay, on the mainstream. I could not agree more than the assassination of Kennedy was an overthrow of the government. And I believe America has not been the same since. Okay? You know, and the MSM doesn't want to hear that because they missed both stories. They missed the whole story about the assassination, what really happened in Dealey Plaza. And then they completely missed the Vietnam angle. I mean, 3 months after Kennedy's assassination, no, excuse me, yeah, 3 months after, Johnson passed NSAM 288, which planned on an air war by the United States Air Force against North Vietnam. This is something Kennedy did not do in 3 years. Johnson did in 3 months. NSAM, Fletcher used to talk about NSAM 288. He thought NSAM 273 got too much exposure, and NSAM 288 did not get enough exposure. And there's a lot of evidence that that's the case, because every historian of the Vietnam War will tell you that NSAM 288 was a milestone on the way to declaring war, okay, against North Vietnam. All right, and just remember that in August of that same year, the Tonkin Gulf incident took place, which I believe was a planned provocation. And that's what got Johnson's Tonkin Gulf resolution through. And then in March of 1965, Johnson completed his reversal of Kennedy's policy and landed combat troops at Da Nang. I don't see how much more clear you can get than that. Yes. So I believe it was an overthrow of the government, and I believe the Vietnam War would have never happened if Kennedy had lived. And the MSM doesn't want to hear that message because they completely missed that story. Completely. It's almost astonishing how much they missed it by. And if it wasn't for Fletcher Prouty and Oliver Stone's JFK, I believe it would have never broken in to the public consciousness, like it did through that film. All right, so thank you so much for the letter, and I hope I outlined some of the things that you can possibly do. It won't be easy, but it's important to stay part of the fight.
Yeah, well, just write one email to Congresswoman
Luna.
Yeah, that's a start. Just, hey, keep up the good work. I support what you're doing.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Lynn.
All right, thank you very much, Jim. And, right, we'll leave it, hopefully, maybe next week.
Okay. Can you give me a rest?
All right, sure. All right. 2 weeks from now. Wait till your next article's finished.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Good night.